Honey, I blew up the business.
Welcome to the podcast, Tracy Shercliffe. Great to have you on.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we're really pleased to have you on because you are an incredible serial tech entrepreneur from the 90s, I believe.
It's a scary thought, isn't it?
Yeah. Since the 90s, back when that was a decade. And so there's a lot of stuff I want to get into with you today because you've got so much incredible experience from many different points of view of the kind of entrepreneurial journey. But my first question is, I'm just curious, how does a farm girl from New Zealand end up becoming a serial tech entrepreneur in London? How does that happen?
Yeah, my dad still thinks that there's some sort of imposter broken in and stolen my identity. I don't know, I'm the youngest of three, and I think what you learn and what you pick up when you come from a farm is the ability to be able to do anything. It's a can-do attitude. We were 3,500 acres in the middle of nowhere with, you know, when the lights went out, it was us. You just had to survive. So you had to be good at fixing things. You had to be good at knowing what to do. It was like you just have to sort it out and kind of work it out. And I think that's kind of probably what's held me in pretty good stead for life. If you're going to be an entrepreneur who picks stuff up and starts with it, you just need to be able to start in the beginning and just keep going and try and work it out as you go. Hopefully you get more right than you get wrong, but sometimes it's just about getting on the road and keeping moving forward. Thanks to that farming girl in New Zealand, right?
So your practical, hands-on, 3,500 acres worth of mucking in has really been...
I'm very practical. I can drive a digger, 40-ton digger. I used to do that in my school holidays. A tractor, ride a horse, a motorbike, a 4x4, you name it, ride a bike, you know, all of those things. It just teaches you to be really robust and, yeah, practical, I guess.
So when did you move to London?
So I, out of university, I got a graduate placement and then I got kind of, we have something in New Zealand called the OE, the big OE, and everybody kind of does it. So I kind of reached the point where I just couldn't wait any longer. So I strapped on a backpack.
What's an OE?
Overseas experience.
Right.
Yeah, so I strapped on a backpack with a girlfriend and I did nearly 6 months across Asia. And I arrived to the UK with £80. There you go. And the rest is history.
Wow.
And my dad saying, no, I'm not lending you any money. You have to come home. And yeah.
So you were stuck. You couldn't leave.
I was pretty much stuck, yeah. I did all sorts of jobs. I actually, this year, during COVID, I got the backpack, because I still have it, the mat pack. I got it put in a Perspex case.
Oh, wow.
It's in my house on the wall, and it's got a little plaque inside it. The girl from down under on top, since 1996, which is when I arrived.
Wow. 96. So this was your seed finance, the £80 finance into your entrepreneurial journey.
Yeah.
So okay, you're sat there in 1996. This farm girl who's managed to sort of drag herself into the UK with a few quid left. So what happens then? So how do you get to?
I ended up being pretty lucky and jumped around a bit. And university. So I've got an undergraduate degree in geology and zoology, and then I've got a first-class master's degree in marketing and management. So it's kind of like one of those, kind of like the whole way I wasn't really sure where I was going. And so I got here and I was like, I had worked in marketing, so I got a job working for, my first job was fiber optic routing for a company called Colt Communications. I didn't even know what that was, but it's okay because I could do it. When they asked me at the interview, can you do that? I'm like, absolutely. Sorry, what was it? Days before Google. Can I look that up? How do we do that? I went from there to working for British Gas on their rollout out of competition. I started in direct marketing. Yeah, and then got invited to work on the business gas team, which was... It was really an exciting time. Nobody else that I knew was excited about it, but in marketing terms, when do you get to work for a brand and your job is to save 19 million customers. Normally, it's to start from scratch and make 19 million customers. And you'd think that's pretty easy, wouldn't you, that you just save them. It wasn't so easy.
Interesting. So, because you were into digital marketing or electronic marketing, as it was called back in the day, way early.
Yeah, I remember at British Gas, I convinced them to buy the first, and I should have bought it myself. This is back when I was a very good corporate citizen. I convinced them to buy gas.co.uk.
Wow.
Why did I not buy that myself?
Yeah, you know, that would have been the best entrepreneurial move.
It would have. But, you know, in the early days, you kind of like, it takes a little bit of wisdom, doesn't it?
Yeah, 100%. Like hindsight is 20/20. But yeah, right. So you're in the corporate game and you're learning your trade from your marketing degree, getting into this new field. You're learning all these amazing skills. And then you set up a company. So yeah. Can you just take us through what made your decision to do that and what happened?
Wow. Actually, this is a little bit heartfelt. I went from British Gas and I went on a little bit of a jaunt with some girlfriends. We bought a van and drove across America, which was an amazing experience. And then I ended up back working for Forte Hotels. And that was a great, great role. I was asked to work as the post house brand manager. I didn't realise. I wanted to work on Heritage because they were much cooler English hotels, but I wasn't English enough for that. So I got the post house hotels, but we rebranded them. And pretty much the story, it gets a little dark actually. A very, very good friend of mine from university in New Zealand was canyoning in Interlaken, and we'd all been over for the weekend. And there was a terrible tragedy. And it's probably one of the greatest losses of human life for New Zealanders outside wartime, outside of New Zealand. And so he lost his life along with 26 other people.
Whoa.
We'd been there, we'd canyoned with him on that Sunday. And it was one of those life-changing experiences. After that, I just basically said, fuck it. I don't want to play the corporate game. I want to do my own thing. I want to, you know, I always wanted to, and I just basically grew a pair. And then I walked in the week after I got back from the funeral and I resigned. My boss tried to talk me out of it and then held me to my notice period, of which I wasn't happy. And I said, nope, now, harder, faster, more. I need to do this now. And that's pretty much, I started content generators on the back of that. Interestingly enough, Forte gave me my first really big contract doing IPEX photography for their hotels. And that's kind of how my first content business was started.
So it's called Content Generators,
mm-hmm.
which is, I was ironic because I thought that's the sort of business that would be launched today. You know, I thought it was interesting how like that there's a concept that's very almost in and of itself ahead of its time.
Yeah, you know what? I actually, somebody keeps saying that to me. It's like, you always choose things that are sometimes a bit early. And we'll probably get to what I'm doing now. And I think that, you know, today, it's like I've kind of got the start of kind of disruption. I mean, my business after content generators with Traffic and Traffic Live, I was one of the first to go into software as a service. You know, back in 2007, it was unheard of, and certainly for a woman. So, yeah, I'm always really sometimes a bit early. So even the same, when I started off and went into electronic or digital marketing, I like new things. I like unusual things, and I don't know, I just gravitate towards them. Or maybe they gravitate towards me. I know. So content generators was all about content and producing content for the web and online, kind of around, you know, the dot-com boom and bust time, which, okay. You know, it's one of those things, if you've lived in it and you talk now about pandemics, it's kind of, for us, it felt like our pandemic at the time.
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
Well, it was like one day things were there and then one day things were very, very different. So it's just about how you cope with change. And there's a brilliant book called Who Moved My Cheese? The two little mice, he and whore. And it's just that whole kind of thing, right? When markets change. We also saw, you know, we had the financial crash, which was even before after the dot-com kind of crash time, you know, so everything's a bit cyclic. So change is, I was thinking that the other day, just getting out of the shower, there's one thing you can guarantee in life, it's just going to keep changing.
Mm. So you were kind of early on in your entrepreneurial career blooded into that reality.
Yeah.
You were kind of... I'm curious to see what happens. This is your first company and you're still kind of relatively new in the country. You're new into this new emerging discipline. So what was, and you're looking back now, what was that experience like?
Well, I had a shock, didn't I? That just said, just do it. So you can do it. Just grow up here and work it out and do it. And that's the advice I give to most people when they say, I'm not sure, should I, shouldn't I? And I'm like, just do it. You know, it's, regret is a greater emotion than fear, but you just need to drive past the fear one, in my opinion.
I love that. Regret is a greater emotion than fear.
Yeah.
That's great. I agree. But that's a great little line there, I think, for people to print out and stick on their wall. This is your first business, Content Generators. What happened with it?
Well, so I ended up, we were doing really, really nicely. And there was that whole kind of like, oh, you have to get investment. You have to get investment. To grow, you want to get investors because that's what everybody was doing. So I listened to everybody else and we went out to the market. We got a load of private, wealthy individuals to invest. And we handpicked them and we spent a lot of time. I spent a lot of time choosing them and who was going to be in and who was going to be out. And then we kind of went forward. And it was brilliant. It was really, really good. However, I spent a fundamental amount of time managing those very small investors. Much more time, I found, to the detriment of the business than I did even managing clients and winning business. And I think for me, I mean, you've asked me about this before, Dan. I struggle with the real desire that's the push even now for businesses to continue to get money and equity in order to make their businesses grow. I think a great idea is honed. The more pressure you put yourself under and the more in the boiler house you are, because you have to get it right. There's a great saying that's also taken me in good stead, which is cut your cloth to fit. Mm. So if you've got 6 weeks left of money to work out a problem, you'll come up with a solution and you'll do the best thing you can with that.
Yeah, I think it's very much the mantra nowadays, or has become the mantra over the last decade, that you get funding, you get money. So you everyone's out there looking to get money. But what you're saying is you have this experience where the money became, or the source of the money became the problem, or a big problem for you.
Well, it became a lot of effort because I don't know because it's just my experience. And everybody comes to it with a different set of skills and experience. But my experience was that I spent a lot of time managing it, much more time, and a lot of time listening to what I was, the feedback I was getting about where the business should be going from the investors, as opposed to driving it where I wanted to go. Mm. And I made the vow when I left that business and was that I was never going to be in that position again, that somebody else was going to get to call the shots. So subsequently, I have grown my businesses on the back of being funded by sales and by my own inputs financially, which, you know, I think is harder. However, I think the rewards are greater when you get to the other side. I also was heavily diluted in a very difficult market. Mm. And I felt a little bit, I guess, bitter or sore in that scenario. Mm. So for me, I think, you know, it's just something that I've now got like a pain and an experience that's not the way that I want to go forward. So my following business, Sonar and Traffic Live, that was born out of sheer grit and determination never to take money or to have investors.
Yeah.
I know. Two sides of the coin.
It's interesting. It's that kind of idea of the resentment that starts to breed in you because of your dilution. And I mean that is a sense of, like, it's a bitterness, and that kind of emotional state is how important do you think that is to an entrepreneur?
I think emotional state is fundamentally important to everything and all that you do. Entrepreneurs have to be better at it because everybody's relying on them and expecting them to keep moving forward when they have the same highs and lows as everyone else, but you just can't share them because that makes other people uncomfortable who are relying on you. Mm. Fact. I think the whole thing, well, certainly for me, and maybe it's the way I'm wired, maybe it's that, you know, would I like 10% of a really big pie or 90% of a smaller pie? I don't know. When you're under the pressure and you don't feel like you're getting rewarded enough for something, and you're taking all of the risks, which I felt like in that scenario where I'd taken a lot of investment and I was doing a lot of the work, but I didn't think the investors were, you know, making the pain as much as I was, then that's just the way that I felt. And I think that hasn't left me, and it's subsequently charted the way that I've gone ever since. You know, I think it is, we are all born out of our experience, which is why, you know, we talk to people about their journeys, because the things that they learn on their journeys are always synonymous with the successes and the failures that they have over time.
So you've come out of content generators and you've learned some foundational lessons.
Yeah.
From negative emotions you've experienced that almost have set your sail for the next 20 years. You know, you've set a direction that's unfolded. Between content generators and Sonar, I believe you had a sojourn back into the corporate world?
I did. So ironically, when I left CGs, we effectively, as we nice affectionately called it, I kept, we created a software platform called The Hub, which was actually what we used to run all of our content kind of projects and various bits and pieces. So that was the beginning of Sonar. And that was the traffic product effectively rebadged and kind of rebuilt later. So no, I kind of left CG and I went, you know, into the corporate world where I got paid a lovely amount of money to help people to launch businesses, which I found really fun, and I had very little responsibility and I was paid a lot of money, and I was like, oh, this entrepreneurial founder stuff, God, you can have it. But soon enough, you know, I got itchy feet again and I couldn't help myself. But it's really nice to play with somebody else's money for a change when you've had all of the stress and loads of responsibility. So a consulting gig at Royal Bank of Scotland, launching two products for them, FastPay, which was a competitor to PayPal, and another one called Trust Assured, which was a digital signature business. I got to play with lots of agencies with other people's money, and it was great. It was a really nice time.
You'd been bitten by the bug.
You know, once you realise that you can't climb the corporate ladder, you know, look underneath the glass ceiling, I just wasn't very good for taking, you know, orders from other people. And I remember we had a go-to-market strategy on FastPay, and I remember presenting it, and I was like, you know what, I wouldn't do option B. Option A is the one I would do. That's the one. But of course, I wasn't ultimately in charge, and somebody else, you know, the person that I was reporting into, consultant or not, said, well, we're doing option A. I was like, no, don't do option A. Option B. And then, of course, you know, I didn't really believe in option, you know, that option. So I was like, okay. So I had to support it to the best of my abilities, but I didn't think that was going to be the best way forward. And subsequently, our launch was good, but, you know, we were a competitor to PayPal. They had way more, even though we were part of a bank, they had way more, you know, gravitas and money and kind of connections. Then they had eBay. Game over, really. But, yeah, it was difficult. So I found that a struggle. When you know in your intuition and your heart tells you the way that you should be going to do something right, and somebody else is telling you to go left. I'm not good at that.
So you're in this great job on the face of it, but you're not happy. And you've been bitten by the bug. And so what did you learn from that experience that took you into your second business, Sonar?
That it is quite nice to be comfortable sometimes, and that you can learn a lot from others. And I think in that business, I saw a lot of how to better manage people, and that people can be exceedingly different in a team, and that's a good thing. because I think I hadn't really seen that before. There was all sorts of things. Every role and opportunity that I've had has shaped me to be where I am today, good and bad. So no, I learned a lot. 100%, I learned a lot.
So Sonar was born. What year did you launch Sonar and your
That was back in 2004.
Right. So Sonar produced a piece of software called Traffic or Traffic Live, was that right?
Yeah, it was called Traffic. So originally it started on a FileMaker platform. It was kind of it was on a server and we used to implement it. And in the very beginning we sold it to small creative businesses, somewhere between, you know, 5 and 7 man agencies, of which there are literally thousands in the UK. And we packaged it to be £7,500 for a 5-user license with 2 days of training. And it was effectively a plug and play solution that you ran on a server in your office that pretty much managed the kind of soup to nuts process of running a creative business, including kind of timesheets and, you know, the estimate and the basic invoicing and outputting. Yeah.
Okay, so you said operational software, you would describe it perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. Project management and kind of workflow is kind of where we ended up. But absolutely, we were kind of a new kid on the block. There was probably only a couple of competitors at that stage. There was Paprika and Synergist, which, you know, they'd been around for a while. We were considered to be new. I focused really heavily on look and feel and UI, probably because of my content digital background. It was always, you know, I always came in with the mantra, if people like to use it, the quality of data in will be great, which means the quality of data out is great. So I was always like, let's make it look really great. And I still do that now. It's how something looks and feels, and UI and UX is fundamentally important.
That's a very good insight and very true. And so this software grew and it became a SaaS product and it went very successful.
Yeah, absolutely. So, we just started selling it. We, you know, used to make telephone calls, phone lists, kind of those traditional type methods that sending emails was like a revelation. And we ended up just continuing to sell more and more of it. There were some days there that, you know, was a bit touch and go, like any business. And being, you know, the founder, I was always the one that ate last. So, you know, you'd have stressful days and you're like, God, how are we going to pay payroll this month? And then they'd be like, well, we need to employ somebody to do this job. It's like, well, not yet, we don't. No, we need 3 more sales before we can do that.
Okay.
Which is ultimately when, you know, you go back to that investment discussion that we had earlier. I regularly say to people when they come to me for investment, could you not just sell more with what you're doing on your current platform? Because if you take my money as investor, you're going to have to give up some of your equity, which means you get less at the end. Can you not just sell more? If you're, you know, you're showing me a business plan that you're going to make money in 2 weeks, can't you do that? So I think that's, you know, that really, really taught me to kind of put the nose to the grindstone and push hard.
So this is, again, to your principle about cutting your cloth to fit.
100%.
So you're right in the trenches here and you're bootstrapping, as it were, your business.
Bootstrapping before that was even a word.
And it's all, so you're in there and it's working. So what happens? So, because I know you ended up with an international presence. So how did that happen?
Well, you know, there's a book which I actually should reread because of my current business, which is called Crossing the Chasm. And it's Take a Market and Dominate It. So we became, we sold more FileMaker licenses than any other business in Europe. So we were selling a lot of our traffic software to all sorts of agencies. We also had a huge amount of in-house agencies. We dominated the UK. And then I went down on holiday to Australia and New Zealand and the markets I understood. And somebody said, why don't you open a market down there? I was like, yeah, great idea. And we did a little bit of marketing and I got a huge piece of like push activity. So we opened an office, which means that I was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to make outbound calls to do demonstrations and talk to clients in Australia. I started an office and put a guy down in the office called Bruno. He sold photocopiers before he sold software. So that was a little bit of a transition. Yeah, phenomenally interesting time. So no, Australia was a very good market for us. And actually, you know, 25% of the business was out of Asia when we exited in 2014.
Well, okay. So you've got this bootstrap business that became an international business.
Yeah, because we just kept going and pushing markets and opening doors, and I'd onboard salespeople and grow the development team, and yeah, it was one of those. I wasn't taking anything out; I was putting everything in.
So, what was the turnover of the business around about the time when you exited in 2014? What was the size of the company?
Well, we were about 85 employees based out of London, New York, and Sydney. So we had three businesses, and our turnover was over about between 4 and 5 million.
Okay, great. And then you sold the business in 2014. You exited the business. So how much did you sell it for?
Multi-millions, so tens of millions. Yeah.
And you sold it to an American business, is that right?
American corporation, yeah.
So you've kind of had this journey from rocking up with your £80.
Yeah.
And what was that? Like 10, 18 years later, you're making tens of millions of pounds in an exit, selling an international business software company to an American software company from having started, you know, grown up on a farm. Which is an incredible journey, right? So you won the game. Right? This is, if you're looking at you now, you're kind of like this woman has come and won. So I'm curious to find out, like, what was that experience like? You know, in 2014, you've won the game. You're lifting the trophy.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Oh, it does. It feels pretty good, actually. I have to say. Well, it's funny. You say it feels when you say it, it feels amazing. But at the time, I was also there was also an enormous sense of loss. Like it was a huge sense of achievement. And you know, we were very lucky. There was a scenario that was several businesses interested in our business. And you know, it felt really, really good. But it's also that whole we were family. I was exceedingly close to the business. I was, you know, sometimes I was working, you know, 16, 20 hours a day. I had two young children at the time. Yeah, there was a lot of stress and pressure, but there was also, you know, huge amounts of, I loved that. I loved that time.
Mm.
I used to spend a week every month in New York, in the New York office, and lots of hours talking to all of the different, you know, the teams and the offices and various bits and pieces. So, no, it was a great time. But it's also, when you look at being part of another business, it looks really exciting. You look at, you know, the fact you're going to get an exceedingly large life-changing amount of money. And you kind of go, I mean, a lot of people said, don't do it yet, Tracy. It's not your time yet. You've got much further to run. But there's always that, there's another addle as well, which is like, you know, always leave a little bit in it for the others. So we were by far, you know, one of the market leaders. We won lots and lots of awards, and it just felt like a good time. And they felt like the right, you know, the right partner. Yeah, but when, you know, post the sale, it was, you know, I'd lost control of something that I'd started. So it's kind of like there's a bittersweet in the whole kind of like process, but no, it felt amazing, and I have amazing memories, and I learned once again lots, not only about the process of exiting, but also about the process of, you know, how you communicate that to the sales teams, the development teams, and people who are working in the business about the new opportunities for them in another business.
So, see, yeah, I mean, it's a real moment in time. You know, your other baby, you've got had a couple of babies, actual babies, but your metaphorical baby, your business has been sold, and you're exiting it, and you've got this life-changing amount of money. I'm just kind of curious as to what how does that impact you personally? I mean, again, it's such a headline thing, but if you're living that kind of experience, what were the bits that were a challenge?
So one of the things, I guess, was understanding, you know, kind of shifting of cultures. So we had one of those cultures that were really, really focused on open, honest, everybody. I was completely approachable. I would be involved in kind of any large pitch. And I went to something that was very American, very corporate. You know, they'd have like a town hall to communicate something that they would plan for a week out. I mean, we would just do the, great, Tracy's going to do like a bit of a speech today about what we're doing and some feedback about this. So we felt like we were kind of from the Wild West, shooting from the hip. In fact, the name of the company, Sonar, was Sinbad the Sailor's Ship, was called the Sonar. So I kind of got that because, you know, I felt like we were a little bit like pirates in the beginning. We were kind of starting out as kind of, and I think that culture was what we always were. We were always like a little bit like unique and kind of, you know, shooting from the hip, I guess is probably a good way to put it. And then we went to this big corporate, you know, that where they had expense counts and everything had to be, you know, you had to fill in forms that we just didn't even know about. And people would come to me and go, Tracy, we've got this form to fill in. I'm like, oh God, really? And so I'd take the form and I'd go off to the, you know, my new counterparts. I'd be like, really? Do we need this form? And they're like, yes, that's part of our, you know, corporate governance. So gelling of two very different cultures and two very different businesses together. There was a little bit of a, so yes, the honeymoon kind of very much went to, oh God, now we've got a marriage. And
right, okay.
Sometimes you're not so nice.
So reality bit.
Yeah. But I think it does in most, you know, to say that wouldn't happen in most acquisitions would be naive.
Sure.
And I think it's, you know, for us, I wasn't in a position where they wanted me to stay in charge. They wanted me to stay in charge from a running and onboarding new customers and growing the business. But certainly I lost control of things like development, which was really important to me. The secret to our success, as I told you in the beginning, was that we also always delivered great looking product and interfaces with things that worked in a smart way. And I would spend time and, you know, good development money making sure that it worked smarter and harder than if it just working wasn't enough. It needed to be worked better than you could think it could work.
Yeah, I get that. So what did you do with your money? Did you have a big blowout?
Bought four houses and a really big yacht.
Really? So you really went for it?
I went for it. Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Where was your yacht?
I put it in the, originally, it was in the south of France. So I had a very big can for a couple of years where I'd have big parties on it and flash around lots of champagne. And, you know, I did some, I launched a few kind of like networking kind of talks and things to kind of encourage women in business and in computing. But no, I had a lot of fun.
So, yeah, I can see you here swilling champagne on your yacht in Cannes with the great and the good, and sounds great.
It was a really lovely time.
was there anything that you would say that you say it was difficult, like losing control of your baby? Was there anything that was kind of more of a shadow side to that? Things that you look back now that were learning moments from that experience?
I think there's always learning, you know, learning moments. I think maybe I could have probably, I mean, I look back now and I'm like, you know, I had to deal as much with anybody as the change of culture. So I could have made it a little bit easier for everybody. So there kind of became a them and us And some of the team have become thems, and some of the team had become us still. So there was like the, you know, the, there was a juxtaposition even in the team in the transition. And I probably could have been a little bit easier to make sure that was helpful. But there was a lot of things that were done or planned that I didn't really agree with. And so I kind of felt that difficult. And I left after 9 months, although at the sale, as part of the sale and a condition of the sale, I only needed to do a 90-day handover, which was also a bit of a surprise. When you've grown a business from scratch and you touch every single part of it, every single person, you know, knew me well and they could communicate with me. And it was a difficult beast, you know, 85 people. It was a lot of stuff to manage. You know, and the change of that was also difficult for me, losing control and... Mm. You know, there was lots of stuff for me to go through, and I think I would process that differently now with the experience of having done it before. But that's no different from, you know, everything else that people experience on their journey. Once you've done it once, you kind of understand what that would be. So,
yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, you learn, like you say, it's always a learning experience. But I'm curious, what are the, now you've done it, looking back at it, how would you have handled that differently just for yourself? What's the tool in that you would learn from that?
So I think the other thing that I did quite quickly is I jumped again. I started back straight to do another one. I probably wouldn't put as much pressure on myself. Notice I say pressure on myself to do that again. I would probably take more time to breathe. Although I did, you know, I was swanning around on the yacht and, you know, doing all of these other projects and a little bit of kind of, you know, encouraging other people and women in business and tech. I was definitely back in the boiler house again, working on my now current business, which is Scope and the Virtue Group. So, you know, I was still getting up every day, you know, hitting the building a team and kind of starting again as soon as I'd exited, you know, within 9 months. And I already had the idea and the plan, so I was already working. I would probably give myself a little bit more of a break, Dan.
You're a glutton for punishment. It's a classic entrepreneur.
I don't know why. I think maybe we're all a little bit broken. They say that you know, the broken bits are where the light comes in. Mm. I don't know. I think I would have needed a little bit more tape for a couple more months. Would be nice.
Well, it's something I've learned. Just the more I work on myself, like I'm trying to understand that bit, the broken bits. The more that there's a more of a flow state through my work, it's less like shifting gears sort of in a kind of rough way. You know, it's more smooth driving. Yeah. Just on your new company, I just want to, I'm curious to sort of find out. Can you just describe it quickly? Because I believe it's around helping people sell time. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the irony of all of this is Sonar and the Traffic Live product was all around project management, workflow and resource planning. So who's doing what when, and ultimately it was linked to timesheets. But I spent, you know, 10 years in that business and I believed in it. However, and it's kind of like one of those things when cycles are due to change, and I sat in front of too many CEOs and CFOs and they were like, you know, we're making the product's great, we're making margin point improvements, but we're still losing money on some projects and jobs, and why? And I kind of can't go without looking at the why. So I looked into it, and the way that the agencies costed for the work that they did is that they put together a staff plan, which ultimately was hours and roles. And then that then went into the project management, and then the project managers would define what they did. So the irony is it's like you're charging someone with hours and roles and then you sell that for a price. However, when you get to actually planning it, you actually do the piece of what you're doing, like the tasks allocation. So why don't you just do this here and then you can price it better? And actually, I kept the rights to keep some anonymized data from the previous platform because we were going to build some data tools to make the businesses better that we were working with. So I was like, well, if we have all of that data and we move it forward. So fundamentally, I think selling time is just wrong. It doesn't add any value to the people buying it. The more you sell them, the more money you make. Not the more effective you are, not the better you feel about what you're delivering. You just make more money and they spend more and So it's kind of like a negative cycle. There's no win-win. Mm. I think as you get further in your journey in business, you want to be, people talk about purpose. For me, it's about making sure that things are win-win. So I was like, I have to fix this. Selling time doesn't make any sense. Although I sold a timesheet system. There's an irony in that. So I was like, well, you don't, if you actually sold things as opposed to hours and people, you wouldn't even need to charge by time. You could charge by the things you're delivering, and then you could free yourself from the constraints and set your own prices, like you would do if you went into a Boots and chose, you know, two body washes off the shelf. You don't pick up one and go, I've added up all the ingredients on here and I've added 20%. So Mr. Shopkeeper, I'm going to pay you £4.25 for this one. And I've done the same for this one and I'm going to pay you £3.50. Like it doesn't, that's, you know, you're paying for the thing and the value you perceive that that's going to give you. And I think it should be the same in services. So I am trying to disrupt a business and stop people from inefficiently selling their time and start the efficiencies of their business and selling things and packaging them in a better way. So Scope effectively does just that for all sorts of professional services businesses.
That's great. And again, my business in effect sells time. And I got to say, it's a rough thing to get into that, because you just measuring out stuff that's impossible to gauge in advance. And I think
100%. And the reason we got to that, Dan, is that it was originally hatched out of the invention of laziness. I mean, you know, the first people, so if you look back and where the marketing and kind of advertising industry got to selling time, it started, you know, 40 years ago, where, you know, actually the media used to put, when there wasn't all of these different platforms and different, you know, now we've got lots of different disciplines. You know, we have, you know, digital and TV and radio and blah, blah, blah. We only have a few. And so effectively what happened was the kind of the change shifted from being at all about, you just made the money in the media, to actually media went off somewhere else in another business. And then the creator had to make money. So somebody obviously walked in and said, well, how are we going to charge our clients for this? And they didn't go to the CEO who said, let's, you know, create a product suite and sell that. No, they went to the CFO who said, okay, well, we'll take some of Dan's time, we'll take some of Tracy's time, and we'll add, you know, a marginal markup on top of that, and then we'll sell that on for the hours we think it's going to take. Mm. Lazy. So it's difficult to price and to decide what you're going to be, what's in your stable to sell, but the upsides of it are enormous around efficiencies and your own value. And at the moment, I hear a lot about, you know, certainly in agencies or businesses want to get to value-based pricing. So, you know, I want to sell the value I'm providing to the business. You can't move to that unless you stop selling hours and time. You have to move to selling things. So that's kind of the transition we're trying to drive. And then hopefully at some point in the future, we can get to really starting to people getting rewarded for the value they're creating in other businesses.
Mm. I love that. Again, I've lived with that problem for 20 years with my own businesses. Again, it's interesting. We're getting to that point of edging towards the end of the podcast here. But what I love about the way we've got to here is your mission going forward is this kind of incredible transformation in terms of how particularly services companies can conceive themselves and add value and create more new value. And I think that's really great and an interesting sort of distillation of a journey you started in the 90s of creating new innovative products and services and distilling this down to the kind of nub of it, really, of what you've got now, is which is if you can make that change, you change everything within that business.
Oh, I just got a spine tingle. I mean, I'm trying. It hasn't been easy. And the irony being, I sat back and said, "Oh, it's all right. I'll have this one done in 5 years." The other one took me 10. 5 years in, I don't even think we've still got the heartbeat that we're watching. We're tracking month to month. This is one of those things where there's a lot of noise now about selling outputs and value versus selling time, and I'm leading that charge, and I'm exceedingly passionate about it. There's that saying, isn't it? She remembered who she was, and the game changed. let's see if I can move the needle.
That's brilliant. I mean, we've had this, we talked about a journey, but what a journey. And you're still on it and you're still fired up for the next phase, which I think is so great and so inspiring, actually. I find it very inspiring. So we've just gone through everything, your career. We've really dug into all these, the highs and the lows and the frustrations and the sort of great joys that you've had. But if you're going to speak to somebody who's just about to start out, perhaps, in fact, a young woman just about to start out. You talked about women in business being a focus for you, and particularly women in technology is a theme that's been a theme for a while. So if someone's starting out, what advice should that young woman ignore? Lots of advice out there.
The naysayers. The people who say no. The people who are like, it can't be done. The people who say the little girl who was grew up on a farm in New Zealand will not be able to come to London, survive on £80, build a multi-million dollar software, global software business, sell it to an American corporation and start again and still have the passion to do something different and to change, hopefully change an industry. Just don't listen to them. It's difficult. It's really difficult. And some days I go to bed thinking, Jesus Christ, what am I doing? And then other days I go, wow, this is a journey and I'm so excited about where I'm going. So it's just try and not listen to the little voice and try and listen to the big voice.
That's really great. Yeah. So listen to the big voice.
Yeah. The one that's the encouraging and not the naysaying voice. And don't listen to the naysayers, because there will be lots of people on your journey that tell you no. Your intuition, follow your intuition. Sometimes it's difficult. The number of people who told me it couldn't be done, but it can.
Well, I think that's a fantastic place to end our podcast today. Listen to the big voice and follow your intuition. Yeah, I mean, and that's just fantastic advice for anybody, by the way. And I struggle with this. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm building a business. I've got a mission I'm on. And I have those niggles at night. You know, I'm like, yeah, man, but maybe you're just stupid. You know, maybe you're going to cock it up again like you did. You know, and these are those little narratives, those voices. Even your own little voice, yeah. Let alone anybody else's, just to see that and acknowledge it and ignore it. I think that's, I will, again, that's given me encouragement too. So thank you, Tracy. That's been really fantastic. Thank you for being so open. Thank you for sharing with us. And just before we wrap up, where should we send people to find out more about you and about Virtue Group? Where should we push people?
That would be lovely. So scopebetter.com is the website for the product. And for me, LinkedIn, please reach out and connect. It's Tracy Shirtcliffe. There's only one of me. It's an unusual name. So I always say it's one of those things that drip off my tongue, which is the shirt you wear and the cliff you fall off. So Tracy Shirtcliffe, by all means, connect me up, and I'd love to chat or help anybody else on the journey that needs some help.
Well, that's very kind. Well, I shall put all those links into the show notes. So if people want to follow those up and take Tracy up on her generous offer. So hit her up on LinkedIn. She's an absolute sort of enormous source of inspiration and wisdom. So thank you so much, Tracy, and I'll hopefully see you again soon.
Brilliant. Thanks, Dan.
If you want to receive the top 5 tidbits, the nuggets, the insights from each episode in your inbox every week, head up to honeyibluupthebusiness.com. Yes, the snappily titled honeyibluupthebusiness.com, and enter your email address. And we're going to get the best bits. We're going to collate them together and we're going to send them to you. So you don't have to write them down when listening to the podcast. Yes, nice and easy. So get up there, enter your email address, get the tips, all good. And I've got to say before I go that this podcast is generously supported by my company, The Tech Department. Thank you, guys. They are indulging me as I'm pursuing this little creative project. If you want to find a company that helps make your technology better so that gets your business better as well, head up to thetechdept.com. So on behalf of everybody here, thanks for listening. See you next time.